This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
According to the state of Florida, the murder of Florida State University law professor, 41-year-old Dan Markell, is quite complicated and involves multiple defendants. Prosecutor Georgia Kappelman leaned forward against the podium as she spoke to the jury on September 26, 2019.
Dan Markell, father of two young boys and highly respected attorney at law and professor at the Florida State University College of Law, was shot twice in the head in his own garage in broad daylight. Who would do such a thing?
Who indeed? Investigators naturally looked at the people closest to Dan, including his ex-wife, Wendy Adelson. They would come to learn that Dan and Wendy had quite a tumultuous divorce and were still currently involved in litigation involving the settlements of their divorce and custody of their two young sons. But their investigation would seemingly take them in another direction, at least at first. After a lengthy and meticulous investigation, Tallahassee police officers finally made two arrests in the case, 33-year-old Luis Rivera and 34-year-old Sigfredo Garcia. At first, to the public at least, there was no obvious connection between Dan Markell and the two suspects. They certainly didn't run in the same circles, and Luis and Sigfredo lived in Miami, while Dan's residence was in Tallahassee. Luis had been in jail already on other charges, federal racketeering charges, when he was arrested for Dan's murder. And it didn't take long for him to cut a deal with prosecutors. He told them that he was, in fact, involved in the murder, but he said Sigfredo, who was his best friend, had hired him to do it with him. And why did Sigfredo want Dan dead? Luis said he had been hired too, by his longtime on-again, off-again girlfriend and mother of his children, Catherine Katie Magbanua. After Luis's confession, Catherine Magbanua was then arrested and taken into custody for first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation of murder. On Saturday, October 1st, 2016, Catherine had just dropped off her two children and was running errands when her car was surrounded by armed police officers, guns drawn. It would turn out that Catherine was just the connection police were looking for. She had been dating Charlie Adelson, who was the brother of Dan's ex-wife, Wendy Adelson.
Charlie Adelson had a sister in Tallahassee, Wendy Adelson. And Wendy Adelson had a problem, and her problem was named Dan Markell. And the solution to that problem was Magbanua, Rivera, and Garcia.
Prosecutors believe that Wendy's family, namely her mom Donna and brother Charlie, wanted Dan Markell killed, and so they enlisted Catherine's help to do it. Catherine then hired Sigfredo, who then hired Luis to do it with him.
Garcia told Rivera that Catherine Magbanua had gotten them a job, and it was a big one. It was going to pay a lot of money.
As I said earlier, this case is definitely complicated. With no one from the Adelson family ever charged, yet heavily implicated by prosecutors, Sigfredo and Catherine went to trial in September 2019, both claiming their innocence, while Luis Rivera would be a star witness against both of them. Would prosecutors be able to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt? Or would the defenses of Sigfredo and Catherine prove that they were being railroaded? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 93. Before Before we get into the trial, a little more about the crime. Dan and Wendy shared custody of their two young sons. Typically, Wendy would have them for part of the week, and then Dan would have them for part of the week. On Friday, July 18th, 2014, Dan had the boys. He dropped them off at daycare at about 8:50 a.m. He then went to work out at Premier Gym. Surveillance video from that gym's parking lot would show that he was being followed.
A light-colored Prius, which they deduced from this surveillance, was silver pine mica. That's the exact color, which appears to follow Dan Markell into the gym parking lot at 9:11 a.m. on the morning of his death. The Prius waits in the parking lot for Mr. Markell to work out, which is approximately an hour. And then the Prius follows Mr. Markell out of the parking lot at about 10:38 a.m.
Surveillance video from the city buses shows the Prius continuing to follow Dan after he leaves the gym, and it follows him all the way to his house. As Dan pulled into his driveway just off Trescott Drive, he was talking on the phone with a man named Stuart Schlazer. Dan had called Stuart to ask his opinion about the school his kids were going to.
Did something unusual happen while you were on that call with Mr. Markell?
Yes.
Could you explain what that was?
He said, "Can you please hold on a second? There's an unfamiliar person in my driveway." I said, "Yeah, sure." And then I waited for him to get back to me. He never did. I heard a loud sound. And then I heard him breathing like this. He never spoke another word to me. I asked him, "Are you okay?" I screamed into the phone, "Are you okay?" And then I hung up and texted him, "Are you okay? Is everything okay?" And then I called 911.
Dan had been shot twice in the head. James Geiger, one of Dan's neighbors, heard a loud bang. He went to the window in the front of his house to see if he could determine where the sound had come from. He noticed a light-colored Prius driving quickly out of Dan's driveway. He first thought maybe there had been a burglar attempt, so he went outside and walked over to Dan's house. The garage door was open and Dan's car was in the garage, engine running. He thought maybe Dan was getting ready to leave, so he walked back to his house. He stood in front and kept looking out the window. He didn't know why, but he wanted to wait for Dan's car to leave. A few minutes passed, and Dan's car was still there, engine running. He said to his wife, "Something seems odd." He walked back over to Dan's house. Everything was still the same as it had been a few minutes before. The garage door was still open. The car was still running. He figured he would walk up to the car and ask if everything was okay.
As I approached the driver's side of the car, I noticed that there was glass right in front of the door, and I immediately looked in at the car at the driver's side through the window, and it had been smashed in, what appeared to be smashed in, and I was startled then to see Dan inside, and his head was bloody, and I immediately said, "Danny, what's happened?" And there was no response, and I yelled out again, Danny, what's happened?" And again, there was no response except that his head was slowly moving from left to right, back and forth. And so my immediate thought then was we had to get medical help there as quickly as possible. And I reached in my pocket for my cell phone to call 911, and my cell phone wasn't there. I had left it in the house on the couch where I'd been originally sitting. So I ran back to my house and grabbed the phone. I came out and started to dial 911.
He fumbled as he dialed. First, accidentally dialing an extra digit, so the call didn't go through. He immediately tried again.
His driver's side window is shattered, and he's battered and can't answer. He's inside. I don't know if somebody tried to shoot him or if he shot himself or what. I don't know.
James pleaded with dispatchers to please hurry, but an ambulance wouldn't arrive at the scene until 19 minutes later. Officer David Sims was one of the first responding officers to arrive.
He was sitting in the front seat of the car. Mr. Geiger had told me his name was Daniel, so when I approached the car, I called out his name, and I got no response. And I got a little closer, called again, no response, and he was sitting in the front seat, kind of slumped forward, and there was a gasping to his breath. But he was not responding to me, and his arms were down in front of him.
Was he able to say any words during the time that you were on scene?
No.
Officer Sims noted that there were no signs of forced entry to the residence and no signs of a struggle or a robbery. Dan was transported to Tallahassee Memorial Healthcare in critical condition. He would survive for another 12 hours before passing away from his injuries. One of the first things officers did was to notify Wendy Adelson. They met her at a restaurant, and she agreed to go back with them to the police station.
There was a shooting at your home or your ex-husband's home at 2116 Trescott, okay? Your ex-husband, Daniel, all right, has been taken to the hospital. He's not going to survive.
Oh, my God.
Okay? Before we get into everything, I have to establish where you were and who you were with and so forth.
Okay.
Okay, and then once we've established all that, I can give you more details.
Okay.
Do you understand why I wanted you to come here before I discuss this?
No, I don't.
Wendy, through tears, said she was scared for her children, that someone did that to Danny, and she was afraid they would now be in danger. She also then said something that undoubtedly caught the detective's attention.
Danny didn't treat me very well, and I'm so scared that maybe someone did this. Not because they hate Danny, but because they thought this was good somehow.
Oh, are you saying that you think maybe one of your friends would have done something like this?
Who would do this?
I don't know. That's why you're here, and that's why we're talking. Would you ever ask someone to do something like this?
Not in a million years.
Okay. Do you think someone would do this for your benefit without asking you?
No.
What good does it serve?
I made my brother, his name is Charlie, the one I'm really close to, he makes a lot of jokes in bad taste, and it was a joke he made. He bought the TV for me this morning that got broken, and I was talking to him about whether it made sense to pay to fix it or whether I should get a new one, and it was always his joke that, like, he knew Danny treated me badly, and it was always his joke. He said, I looked into hiring a hitman, and it was cheaper to get you this TV, so instead I got you this TV.
Okay.
I mean, he would never. He's my big brother, and he's been taking care of me since I was little, but he would never. And I told that to the repair guy this morning.
Right. That's okay.
I said, he asked me how much it cost, and I said I didn't know because it was a gift, because my brother said it was cheaper than a hitman. It was my divorce present.
Okay.
Such a horrible thing to say. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
But even my family, who felt like I had been mistreated, would never do something like this. Never.
Wendy also gave the detectives the name of her ex-boyfriend, Jeffrey LaCasse, as a possible suspect. During their investigation, detectives contacted cell phone companies and got the records of all the cell phones that had been in the area of Premier Gym at the time that Dan was there, being followed. They then cross-referenced to see if any of those phone numbers had ever been in contact with anyone from the Adelson family. They discovered that Sigfredo Garcia's phone had been there, and Sigfredo's phone had actually had contact with Harvey Adelson, Wendy's father, earlier that month. Detectives were also able to trace the light-colored Prius back to a rental car company, and whose name was on the rental car agreement? Luis Rivera. At the top of the agreement was a second contact the company had taken for the car. That contact's phone number belonged to Sigfredo Garcia. And so Luis and Sigfredo were arrested, and after Luis confessed, Catherine was arrested too. But despite their efforts, and there were definitely many efforts, detectives were unable to arrest anyone in the Adelson family. Sigfredo and Catherine were tried together in September 2019. In her opening statements, Prosecutor Georgia Kappelman spoke a lot about the Adelsons.
Emails between Wendy Adelson and her mother, Donna Adelson, that occur around the time of this litigation, about 1 year before the murder, indicate that Donna Adelson despised Dan Markell and was desperate to find a way for Wendy and these two kids to move down to where she was located in South Florida. Donna Adelson in these emails refers to Dan Markell as a religious zealot, a bastard. She says, "Let's show this F blank, 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 blank what will make him absolutely miserable," and proposes a plan of action for how to threaten and or bully and or bribe Dan Markell into allowing Wendy to move to South Florida with the children. These plans included converting the children to Catholicism, even though the entire family was Jewish. All the Adelsons were Jewish as well. But this suggestion was a way to gain leverage against Mr. Markell because Dan Markell was very observant in his faith, and it was very important to him that his children be raised in an environment that observed and was committed to the Jewish faith. The divorce between Wendy and Dan Markell was final back on July 31st of 2013, but as I mentioned, the litigation continued as both sides filed pleadings back and forth in reference to alleged violations of the divorce agreement, in reference to child custody, and specifically one of the last pleadings filed prior to Dan Markell's murder is in reference to Wendy Adelson's mother, his mother-in-law, Donna Adelson. And in this pleading, he alleged that the children's grandmother, Donna Adelson, was disparaging him to the kids. And he was petitioning the court to order that Donna Adelson not be allowed to have unsupervised contact with his children, her grandchildren. A ruling was never made on that motion because Dan Markell was murdered before the hearing was conducted.
Prosecutor Kappelman told the jury that Wendy will testify, and she will say that she sure hopes someone didn't do this on her behalf.
She will tell you that her brother, Charlie Adelson, who also lives in South Florida with her mother, not with, but in the same area as her mother, Donna Adelson, and her father, Harvey Adelson. She'll tell you that Charlie, quote, looked into hiring a hitman, but decided buying her a TV as a divorce present would be cheaper. And what was her alibi for the murder? Where was she when Dan Markell was killed? She has a witness who was present at her home, a repairman who was fixing that very TV, an appointment that was set up by her mother, Donna Adelson. So Wendy's brother, Charlie Adelson, has made references to hiring a hitman to kill Dan Markell, and now hitmen have murdered Dan Markell.
She told the jury how investigators came to suspect Luis and Sigfredo. She said that the two men actually made two trips from Miami to Tallahassee. The first trip was in early June, about 6 weeks prior to Dan's murder. That trip was intended to be the murder trip, but it ended up being more of a scouting trip instead. The two men returned to Tallahassee in July. She said that on July 18th, 2014, they followed Dan to the daycare where he dropped off his kids. They then followed him to the gym and then to his home. She said Lewis pulled the Prius into the driveway behind Dan and Sigfredo got out. Sigfredo then approached Dan's car and shot him twice through the driver's side window. He then hopped back into the Prius and they headed back towards Miami. Prosecutor Kappelman said phone records for Lewis and Sigfredo show that their phones were consistent with being off at the time of the murder, but were back on when they were driving back to Miami. She said the very first call that was made when their phones were back on was from Sigfredo to Catherine.
And what does he say? He says the job is done. And what does she reply? She says, I know. There's a brief discussion about when they'll get their money. And Catherine Magbanua says, don't worry about the money. I will get the money. You'll get it tomorrow.
The next day, she said Catherine called Lewis. She told him that she had the money, but couldn't find Sigfredo. They all later meet at Lewis's house, where Catherine then pays them. The money is in $1,000 stacks, stapled together. A bizarre detail that would come up again later in the trial. Following the murder, Prosecutor Kappelman said Lewis and Sigfredo each bought motorcycles, and Sigfredo got a car. She said Catherine got a car too, a black Lexus, whose previous owner happens to be Harvey Adelson. She noted that Catherine was also put on the payroll at the Adelsons' dental practice shortly after the homicide, and she began receiving regular checks for approximately the next 2 years, although she said law enforcement has yet to determine what, if any, service she provided at that dental office. Prosecutor Kappelman said Catherine also got breast augmentation surgery after the homicide and trips that Charlie paid for that didn't involve him. She said Catherine also deposited large amounts of cash into her bank account, sometimes multiple deposits at different banks in the same day. In an effort to figure out everyone who was involved, she said police then decided to conduct an undercover operation.
And to prove how information flowed, how was the conspiracy structured? We, on April 19th, 2016, so almost 2 years after the murder, law enforcement conducts an undercover operation. They got court authorization to go up on a wire, what's called a wire, on Catherine Magbanua's phone and also Charlie Adelson's phone, which means they could listen in real time to what was being said on these phones. That's, despite some popular belief, not something the government normally can do without special authorization. In this case, that authorization was put in place, and law enforcement was prepared to listen to both Catherine Magbanua's calls and Charlie Adelson's calls. They then sent an undercover agent posing as someone who basically was on behalf of Rivera to walk up to Donna Adelson on the street and basically try to extort money out of her. This undercover officer handed Donna Adelson a piece of paper. And on the paper is a story about the death of Dan Markell. It includes a photograph of Dan Markell. And written on the page is a phone number and the amount $5,000. And the undercover agent, I'm summarizing, tells Donna Adelson, basically, my buddy Rivera, he didn't say the word Rivera, but my buddy's sitting in jail, and you're out here taking care of Katie and Tuto. So basically, he's asking for $5,000 for Rivera to even things out. So now law enforcement starts listening to the calls. Like, you know, we do this little thing. It's 2 years after the murder. We do this undercover operation to try to generate some chatter and see who will say what to whom. And you'll get an opportunity to hear some of those phone calls that result from this undercover operation. That phone number, the undercover agent's phone number that's written on that piece of paper that's handed to Donna Adelson, you're going to see that it travels from Donna to Charlie to Katie and then to Sigfredo.
In his opening statements, Sigfredo's attorney, Sam Zangane, immediately attacked the deal prosecutors made with Luis Rivera.
7 years in Florida State Prison. That's what Luis Rivera got in exchange for his participation in a first-degree murder case. And who gave him a 7-year deal offer? The prosecution. So you have to think and you have to ask yourself, what did the prosecution get in return for the deal of the century? What did the prosecution get for giving a defendant with an extremely long criminal history, including a recent federal conviction for racketeering as a Latin king? What did he give? Did he give the information of a mob boss or a drug kingpin, a foreign or domestic terrorist, a hiding school shooter? No. He gave up Sigfredo Garcia. And why does that matter? Why does what he gave up matter? Why does Luis Rivera's information in this case matter? Because as it's clear from the government's opening statement, their focus in this case is on the Adelsons. Donna Adelson, Charlie Adelson, Wendy Adelson, that's who their real targets are. And so what do? They go after the low-hanging fruit. They go to Luis Rivera, who was charged with first-degree murder and subject to the death penalty. And they tell him, we're going to cut you a deal where you only have to serve 7 more years.
Zangane then essentially said that Luis's story wasn't credible. For example, he told the jury that there are no phone records that show that Sigfredo went with Luis to Tallahassee in early June. That first trip, Luis said, that was supposed to be the murder trip, but ended up as a scouting one. He said, in fact, during that trip, Luis rented a car and got pulled over by a Florida Highway Patrol officer. He said that officer will testify that Luis was alone in the car.
The government has hitched their wagon to Luis Rivera. That's this case, okay?
He said the only person who will put Sigfredo at the murder scene and will tell you that he got out of the car and shot Dan is who? It's the guy who got the 7 years, he said. The guy who got the deal of a lifetime. He then went after the notion that Catherine would have Sigfredo kill someone for Charlie.
Now, the evidence is going to show that my client has children with Miss Meg Miles. He loves her. That's his girlfriend. That's his wifey. But they were going through a rough patch. And you know who she was dating? She was dating Charlie Adelson. They want you to believe, and the evidence will show from the government's own witnesses, that Sigfredo Garcia was in love with Katie, and he was not happy, not one bit, that this dental playboy that drives around in a Ferrari with nice hair and big muscles and a long, long wallet was with his wifey. They want you to believe that this man, whose heart was broken, decided, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and help out the guy that's with my wife.
He said Charlie is a smart guy and knew Sigfredo didn't like him. He said it was their belief that Charlie solicited Luis and that Sigfredo had nothing to do with it.
Luis Rivera, a known drug dealer, a known supplier of, he is a pharmacy from soup to nuts, from steroids to cocaine. He supplies it. And it's our position that he has a relationship with Charlie Adelson. It's our position that he was the drug supplier for Charlie Adelson. And Charlie Adelson made a decision to instill and to solicit this murder for hire from Luis Rivera. And do you think Luis Rivera, he took the $100,000, but do you think he's going to tell his buddy Sigfredo, hey, I'm going to help out the guy that's sleeping with your wife? The Latin Kings have a code of silence. He'll tell you about it. It's known. The Latin Kings are an organization that they're known to keep their mouths shut. It is in their Bible. There's been specials on HBO about it. And so Charlie Adelson, who's an educated man, instills the services of a known gang leader. not 6 feet of our seat.
One of Catherine's attorneys, Tara Cowis, told the jury that the only reason Catherine was even involved in the case is because prosecutors are obsessed with the Adelsons.
Prosecutorial desperation. That is the only reason why Catherine McVanwell is sitting before you today, charged with a crime that she had absolutely nothing to do with. The prosecution's relentless obsession with arresting the Adelson family has led to this day, this moment, in this courtroom, where an innocent person is being accused of a crime that she did not commit.
She said Catherine grew up in Miami and is a hardworking woman with a BA in health administration. She noted that Catherine loves her children and wants to provide a good life for them. She said the only thing Catherine is guilty of is having horrible taste in men. She told the court that Catherine and Sigfredo were constantly breaking up and getting back together. But in 2013, Catherine was done. She kicked Sigfredo out and they broke up. But they were still in constant communication because he was the father of their kids.
Now, a few months later after their breakup, she was working at a dental office called Sophie Dental on South Beach in Miami. And in walks Charlie Adelson and walks into her life, the second man that she has horrible taste for. Because you are going to learn that Charlie Adelson, they will describe him somewhat of a playboy. At the time, he was 37 years old, single, dentist, good income, no kids. The state is going to try and make it seem like he is a millionaire or a billionaire, but it wasn't like that. He was all about fun, though. And Catherine, she knew this. Charlie is not one to be shy about what he wants out of life, which is not to settle down. So even though they were having a good time and they were dating, Catherine knew this was not going to end up anywhere serious like marriage.
She told the jury that the state's theory is that the Adelsons orchestrated the killing and the link between them and Sigfredo and Lewis is Catherine, that Catherine had to have been behind this. She noted that there had been a phone call weeks before Dan's death between Sigfredo and Harvey Adelson, Wendy and Charlie's father, but said the state doesn't want to highlight that because it means that Catherine's involvement makes no sense if there is a link between Sigfredo and Harvey. She implored the jury to use their common sense.
Do not check your common sense at the door, ladies and gentlemen, because common sense is going to be the only tool that you will need to see that Catherine was just a pawn in Charlie Adelson's plan to kill Dan Markell. And now the prosecution is trying to use Catherine as a pawn to get to Charlie Adelson. That is the only reason that we are here.
She said the prosecution wants you to believe that Catherine took money to coordinate the murder of a man she had never met for a guy she had only known for less than a year. She said the state wants you to believe that Catherine asked the father of her kids, who she was separated from at the time, to commit a murder for her new boyfriend. Any way you look at it, it just doesn't make sense, she said. As for the cash deposits Catherine made, she said Catherine was working several jobs, jobs that paid her in cash. She worked in the club scene and at a liquor promotion company. She told the court that you make a lot of cash doing that in Miami. As for the paychecks from the Adelson's dental practice, the Adelson Institute, she asked why the Adelsons would put her on their payroll and file taxes on her if they were trying to secretly pay her. She insisted that Catherine did work for them. She worked for Charlie. Just because she didn't work there at the Adelson Institute didn't mean she didn't work for him, she said.
The prosecution has dug up every single piece of evidence that they could. They have dug and ripped apart Catherine McManus's life. They have gone into everything. Her phone records, her taxes, her medical records, and nothing. No direct evidence that she was involved. Zero. And that's because she wasn't involved. How far are they going to go, members of the jury, before they stop?
The state's case started with the account from Dan's neighbor, James Geiger, about how he came across Dan's body in his car. He said he saw a light-colored Prius driving away from the scene. Then they got into the forensic evidence, which didn't really seem to provide much clarity in this case. Remember that the state claims that Sigfredo walked right up to Dan's car window, shot him through the glass, and then left. So he likely didn't touch the car or didn't go inside the home. There were also no shell casings found at the scene. But one forensic analyst did testify that he believes the shooter was likely a taller person rather than a shorter one. This fits with the prosecution's theory and corroborates Lewis's confession that Sigfredo pulled the trigger, since Sigfredo is significantly taller than Lewis.
And what are the assumptions that have to be in place to render that opinion?
That the victim was sitting upright within the driver's seat, the door was closed, that the shooter was standing in proximity to the doorway of the car, and that they were standing in a more normal shooter stance with the arm extended out with the handgun at the in the hand pointed toward the victim.
You know, we've got two potential suspects in this case, one about 5'4 and one about 6'1. Is it your opinion that if all those things are in place, that it's the evidence is more consistent with the 6'1 person having done the shooting?
Yes.
On cross-examination, the analyst said he's not 100% positive that a taller person fired the gun. It's just that under his analysis and through his expertise, it's consistent with what he knows. Dr. Anthony Clark, the associate medical examiner, testified that Dan was first shot in the left cheek and then in between his eyebrows. He said Dan lifted his arm up in a defensive motion right before he was shot. An abundance of surveillance video was also shown to the jury, video from the Premier Gym's parking lot and from the Tallahassee City bus system from just before and after the murder. Before the murder, the Prius can be seen just 10 seconds behind Dan's car at a stoplight. After the murder, the bus surveillance system shows inside the Prius, where you can make out two occupants. The passenger is wearing a white shirt and appears to be fidgety, or as the lead investigator put it, very animated and excited. It's hard to make out any details of the occupants or what they're wearing beyond that. Then later on the day of the murder, at 6:47 p.m., surveillance video from an ATM at a Chase Bank in Miami shows a car with a man who looks like Luis Rivera in the driver's seat making a transaction. A taller man wearing a long-sleeved white T-shirt is in the passenger seat. Investigator Craig Isom testified about the hostility between Dan and Wendy during and after their divorce. He said they filed motion after motion against each other. He also found in the divorce filings that Wendy was seeking to relocate with the kids south to Broward County, where her parents resided. The judge had denied her request. Investigator Isom testified that he also conducted an analysis on Wendy's laptop and reviewed emails between Wendy and her mom, Donna. The emails, he said, furthered his suspicions of a possible motive. He said Donna suggested threatening Dan with taking the children to a Catholic church, despite being Jewish, and also suggested that each member of their family pitch in money, totaling $1 million, to bribe Dan so he would allow the kids to move to South Florida. Investigator Isom started to testify that there was a $2 million life insurance policy out on Dan, but the defense objected and it was sustained. Investigator Isom recalled attending the memorial service for Dan. While there, he asked for Wendy's parents, Donna and Harvey, to come to the police station for an interview, but they did not. He said he attempted to talk to Wendy the Monday after the memorial service, but he said she hung up on him, and so he never contacted her again. He told the court that they looked into the phone records of Charlie, Donna, and Harvey, but none of them were in Tallahassee at the time of the murder. On cross-examination, Catherine's other attorney, Chris DeCoste, asked Investigator Isom about the Lexus Catherine was driving after the murder, the Lexus that had belonged to Harvey Adelson.
Now, it fits your theory if she's driving around in the Adelson's Lexus. It fits your theory that she's somehow involved in this, right?
Yes.
It doesn't fit your theory, though, if what it actually was that she bought an old, beat-up Lexus from a friend for $1,700. Right?
If that, I'm not sure what the question is in there. I'm trying to...
We'll come back to that one.
Catherine's defense team says that Catherine actually purchased the car from Charlie. DeCoste asked if Investigator Isom had ever inquired about the condition of the Lexus.
Had it ever been in any accidents?
I don't recall.
Did you ever subpoena any records to find out if it had ever been in an accident?
No.
You would agree with me that a car with multiple accidents could affect the value?
Yes.
No pictures were ever taken of the car for us to be able to show this jury what kind of car it is, right?
I don't have any photographs of the car.
You're just here to say it was a Lexus, right?
The title for the 2001 Lexus was displayed for the jury. DeCoste said the only thing this shows is that it was a legitimate purchase. DeCoste also accused him of not properly investigating Catherine's employment status. Investigator Isom said he learned through witnesses that Catherine had been working at nightclubs, but he never saw any actual information that showed she worked at any of them. But he also never contacted the establishments to see if she had been working there. DeCoste said that Catherine had a job working with Charlie and that it was in patient communication. He asked why Investigator Isom never interviewed any patients.
Did you subpoena patient records from the Adelson Institute so that you could communicate with patients and find out?
No.
What about going down to the Adelson Institute and waiting for patients to come out and talk to them and ask them, have you ever spoken to Catherine McBannell?
I did not ask any patients that, only employees that were at the Institute when at the office when we delivered subpoena.
You don't have any evidence that Catherine McBannell was not actually working at the Adelson Institute, earning every penny she was paid, communicating with patients. Right?
Correct.
Next to Louis Rivera, Wendy Adelson was a very highly anticipated witness in the trial as well. Before the jury entered the courtroom, the judge informed her that she has immunity with anything she's questioned about. He told her that anything she says can't be held against her, but that she's required to answer all questions. Wendy's attorney was also present in the courtroom. Wendy started off her testimony in front of the jury by telling them that she's also an attorney. She said she and Dan met in 2004 and got married 2 years later, in 2006. They first moved to Tallahassee in August 2005. They lived there for about a year and then spent a year living in Miami. They moved back to Tallahassee in 2007. She said they moved there both times for Dan's employment, but she told the jury that she enjoyed living there. She said she's originally from Broward County and now lives in Miami-Dade County along with her parents. Her brother Charlie lives in Broward. She said she and Dan had two sons who are now 10 and 8 years old. Wendy then testified about her family. Her dad is a dentist and has his own dental office, the Adelson Institute. Her mom helps out with her dad's office, and her brother Charlie is a periodontist.
Would you describe your parents as being over-involved in your personal business?
As compared to other people's parents?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wendy testified that she and Dan separated in the fall of 2012. Part of their disagreements were that they had different ways of practicing their faith. She was asked about a motion she filed on January 14th, 2013, where she asked the judge to allow her to move to South Florida with the kids. The motion had been denied.
And were you upset about being stuck in Tallahassee?
I was relieved.
You were relieved. You wanted to stay in Tallahassee.
I was happy at my job.
Wendy and Dan's divorce became final on July 31st, 2013. Wendy said she doesn't recall many of the accusations in the various motions they filed against each other.
Would you consider your divorce with Mr. Markell to be a nasty divorce?
I think most divorces aren't very pleasant.
Okay, but this one was, like, really unpleasant, right?
I found getting divorced to be unpleasant, yes.
And in the litigation that ensued between the two of you, you guys argued over things as small as a tennis racket, I noticed in one pleading.
I don't remember that.
Did he threaten to press kidnapping charges against you?
Objection, hearsay.
Overruled.
I don't remember that, no.
Did he threaten to go after your law license? Remember that?
I don't remember that, no.
Do you remember him saying you failed to disclose a bunch of assets in the divorce process?
I do remember that.
They reached a settlement eventually, just before having to go to trial. She was asked if she remembered the motion Dan filed on March 26th, 2014, involving the allegation that her mother, Donna, was disparaging him to the children.
I don't remember, but if you'd like to show me the motion, I can take a look.
Okay, but you don't remember that portion?
No.
All right. Do you remember the allegation that your mother made statements to the children that Grandma hates you?
Overruled.
Grandma says you're stupid, your father is trying to take my sunshines away, anything like that, do you recall?
No, but again, I'm happy to look at it if you'd like to show me.
I understand. Do you recall that Mr. Markell was seeking sanctions against you personally in that motion?
I don't remember that.
Do you know whether this would have been a motion that you would have shown to your mother? Would she have been aware of it?
I probably would have shown my mom the motion.
Is it fair to say that your parents are very protective of you?
I think that's fair to say.
Is it fair to say that your brother is very protective of you?
I think that's fair to say.
Wendy was asked whether her family liked Dan. She said at the time of the divorce, she does feel like they were angry with him, that they felt like he had treated her badly.
And the motion to preclude your mom from having unsupervised contact with your kids, that was still pending at the time of his murder, correct?
That's possible. I mean, I don't think anyone took that motion very seriously.
Okay. Did your mom take it seriously?
I don't think so.
Did Dan Markell take it seriously?
I don't know how Danny felt about a motion. If he wrote the motion, he was probably taking it seriously.
Prosecutor Kappelman brought up the emails investigators discovered between Wendy and her mom. She was asked why they refer to Danny as Gibbers in the emails. She responded that Gibbers was a nickname she gave Danny when he was being difficult and causing her a lot of pain. It made him feel less threatening, she said.
So it was a derogatory thing?
I wouldn't say it was derogatory.
Did you call him that to his face?
No, I called him Danny to his face.
Okay.
The judge then asked Wendy how to spell Gibbers. I don't know that I ever spelled it out, she said. She told him she thinks it's spelled with a J, but she guesses you could spell it with a G. Then Prosecutor Kappelman interjected.
Ms. Adelson, you had Mr. Markell's phone number programmed into your phone as J-I-B-B-E-R-S, didn't you?
That's right.
Wendy was then asked about her brother Charlie's feelings towards Dan.
He would listen to me when I would tell him about things I was upset about at the time with the divorce. So whether he liked him or didn't like him, he certainly was supportive of me.
Okay, but he never expressed any dislike?
No.
Did he mention hiring a hitman to kill your husband?
Objection, hearsay.
Overruled.
No.
Did he ever joke about he looked into hiring a hitman, but buying you a TV as a divorce present would be cheaper?
He did make that joke. He tended to repeat himself, and sometimes he would make jokes that weren't very funny about all kinds of things.
All right, and was that TV, did he buy you a TV as a divorce present?
He did.
And was that TV the same TV that was being repaired at your residence at the time that your husband was murdered?
It was.
Who made the arrangements for that TV repair?
I did.
Your mom didn't make those arrangements?
I don't believe so.
Prosecutor Kappelman then asked Wendy if after the murder, Charlie ever took her out for a celebration dinner. Wendy said no.
Do you recall any dinner where shortly after Mr. Markell's death where you were with Mr. Charlie Adelson and vomited?
I do remember that dinner. I'm sorry?
Go ahead. I interrupted you.
After Danny died, I was terrified that someone was going to come after me or my children and harm us as well. And so I didn't leave my house for about a month. And when I finally felt ready to leave the house and have dinner, I told my brother that I wanted to have dinner, that I was ready to finally go to a restaurant and eat a meal again. And I'd barely eaten for a full month just out of grief and shock. And so that night when I finally ate for the first time, they ended up taking a while before they sat us, and they sat us at the bar and I had a drink. And I wasn't used to eating anything or drinking alcohol. And I threw up at the table, the only time in my life I've done something like that. But it was certainly not a celebration.
And you never heard your brother refer to it in that way?
No.
Prosecutor Kappelman asked Wendy if she was involved in a plan to kill Dan. She said no. She asked her if she knew of any plan to kill Dan. She said no. Wendy told the court that she has met Catherine Magbanua before, once at a dinner with her brother Charlie, and another time she said she may have gone to the beach with her and another friend for a few hours. Prosecutor Kappelman showed a photo of Wendy and Catherine at the beach with another friend of Catherine's. The photo was taken on Father's Day weekend in June 2014, a little over a month before the murder. Wendy told the court that Charlie is currently 43 years old and has a child with someone now. She was asked if Charlie gives gifts to his former girlfriends, and she said she has no idea. She was then asked if she ever met Sigfredo Garcia, and she said no. On the week before Dan's murder, Wendy said she was in South Florida celebrating her father's birthday. Prosecutor Kappelman asked her if she knew if Dan was planning on leaving town the day after he was murdered. I believe he was, Wendy said. She said she thinks he was going to New York to visit his girlfriend. Wendy was asked to review recorded phone calls in the case. The prosecution team had asked her to identify voices on the calls, and so she sat down with her lawyer and did that. She said she recognized Charlie's and Donna's voices on some of the calls. She wanted to clarify, though, that she only listened to parts of the calls so she could authenticate who was speaking, but that she didn't listen to the full calls. On the day of Dan's murder, Wendy said she was home until about 12:30 p.m. She said she was going to lunch, but first stopped at a liquor store and purchased bourbon for a wedding party she had later.
And did you make any stops between leaving your residence and going to the liquor store?
Maybe I purchased gas?
I don't know if you did or not, but I'm referring to your visit to the crime scene.
I did not visit the crime scene.
You did not pull up to the crime scene tape on Trescott Drive?
No. I was driving on Centerville Road, and sometimes I would take the shortcut through Trescott.
Yes, ma'am.
But when I was driving on Centerville Road, I saw some sort of tape or obstruction, and so I didn't turn.
She said she went right from the liquor store to the restaurant. When asked if she stood to gain anything financially from Dan's death, she said no. Prosecutor Kappelman asked her if she remembers her mom suggesting a plan to offer Dan $1 million so she could take the kids and move to South Florida. Wendy said she's sure she knew about it at the time it happened, and she had her memory refreshed about it recently, but she said she never made that offer to Dan.
Did you move to South Florida after their father was killed with the children?
So after he was killed, I packed a weekend bag and went to South Florida for what I thought would be a couple of days, maybe a week. My son's birthday was July 29th, and I thought we'd be back in Tallahassee by then.
Did you ever come back?
I did come back a few times, but not permanently.
Okay, so you ended up moving there permanently.
I wouldn't say it's permanent, but I'm living there right now.
Okay. Well, it's been 5 years.
It has been a while. I've been exploring options for employment in many different places.
Wendy was then asked when she changed her children's last names from Markel to Adelson.
After Danny died, there was a lot of press coverage. And CNN put pictures of my children's faces unblurred on national television. Newspapers put their names without any consideration to the fact that they're children.
And I appreciate that, but the question is, when did you change their names?
When they started school, I registered them under my name, hoping it would keep them safe.
Mm-hmm. And was that approximately a year after their dad was killed?
It was whenever I registered Ben for school, so it was soon after. Okay. But I didn't legally change their name until after that.
Wendy testified that she also eliminated her older son's legal middle name.
And that was a name that came from Dan Markell's deceased maternal grandmother. Is that correct?
The name started with an A, which was to honor my grandfather, Aaron Adelson. And the second half of his name was to honor Danny's grandmother.
Okay.
So we lost an honor to both families.
On cross-examination, Sigfredo's attorney, Sam Zangane, asked Wendy about her brother Charlie's lifestyle, who he hung out with, what clubs he went to, what sort of people he associated with. Wendy responded that she's busy with her kids and doesn't go out with her brother very often, so she doesn't know any of that.
And what kind of car does he have?
For a while, what does he have? What is he driving right now? Well, he likes cars. He
has a lot of cars, right? And these aren't like Hondas or Toyotas. They're Mercedeses and Ferraris, right?
He drove an unmarked police car for a while.
But that wasn't my question. My question was, did he ever have a Mercedes?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, and it wasn't like a C300. It was like a 5 Series, right?
I honestly don't know anything about cars.
Well, it was the bigger Mercedes, right?
It was big.
It was the bigger one. And he also had a Ferrari, right?
I know he had one really fancy car, but I don't remember what brand it was.
Okay. So you're telling this jury that you don't remember if your brother had a Ferrari?
Cars are really not important to me. You saw mine. I drove a minivan.
Well, but you're not your brother, right?
I am not my brother. I knew he had a fancy car. I just don't remember if it was a Porsche or if it was a Ferrari. It was something fancy.
Something kind of fancy,
yeah.
Right? Okay. So you have a pretty successful brother, right?
He's successful, yeah.
And he likes to show off his success with his extravagant cars, correct?
He likes fancy cars.
Okay. Handsome guy. In good shape, right?
He's handsome.
And you indicated that he had a lot of girlfriends, right?
Yes.
He asked if she knows whether Charlie ever used drugs.
Are you aware if your brother took steroids?
No, I'm not aware if he took steroids.
What about if your brother used illicit drugs?
I'm not aware of my brother using illicit drugs.
And the fact that you're not aware if he used it doesn't mean he didn't use it, correct?
No, I'm just saying I don't know.
Do you know when Luis Rivera started serving your brother drugs?
I don't know anything about that.
Catherine's attorney, Tara Cowis, then asked Wendy questions.
Now, you stated on direct examination that you are a lawyer.
I am a lawyer.
Right. So you understand that the oath that you took before you took the stand, correct?
Yes.
You know the consequences of not being truthful here.
Of course.
And you also have a separate obligation as an attorney to tell the truth, right?
Of course.
Okay. Now, do you know who killed Dan Markell?
No.
Did your brother have anything to do with killing Dan Markell?
I don't believe so.
Your mother is Donna Adelson?
She is.
Where is she right now?
Right now, she's with my children.
In Tallahassee?
In Miami.
Okay. She's not in jail?
No.
She's never been arrested before?
No.
Okay. She's not even testifying in this case, is she? To your knowledge?
To my knowledge, no.
What about your brother, Charlie? Is he in Miami right now?
He's probably in Fort Lauderdale right now.
Okay, but he hasn't been arrested?
No.
Hasn't been charged?
No.
And he's not testifying in this case, is he?
No.
Okay. Are you aware if the state has attempted to subpoena them to come to court?
I believe they have received a subpoena to come to court.
Okay, and it was for them to come and testify in this trial, or you don't know?
I don't know for certain.
Okay. But you know they've received some form of subpoena.
I heard about that.
She was asked if she's been following the developments of this case and whether she's aware of all the publicity surrounding it.
Have you been keeping up with the media coverage in this case?
I don't watch any media related to this case.
Okay. So, but you are aware of the attention that has been brought on this case?
I'm aware only because of the constant death threats that I receive, yes.
Okay. So just to specify, you haven't watched any of the specials that have been on air about this case?
I have not watched any of them.
Do you know if your parents have watched any of the specials on this case?
I advise them not to. They may have seen bits of them, but I don't know for certain.
What about your brother Charlie?
I don't know.
Did you watch the state's opening statement in this case?
I did not.
You did not?
I did not.
Okay. So you're not aware of what the state's theory is in this case?
I'm not.
Regarding the recordings she had received from the state, Wendy reiterated that she didn't listen to the entire recordings, only portions of them, so she could identify the voices. Kawas then asked her how she went about getting a divorce from Dan.
You just left your divorce papers on a mattress of Dan Markell in the house and left out. Is that correct?
No.
How is it that you delivered the divorce papers to him?
I called him to let him know that I wanted a divorce. It wasn't the first time I asked for a divorce, but it was the last time. And told him that I would see him when he got home. Not home, but back to Tallahassee. And then I did leave the papers for him, but I didn't leave town. I was still in Tallahassee.
Okay. So he was actually aware of the like that you were going to be seeking a divorce before you actually delivered the papers to him?
I had asked for a divorce several months earlier.
Okay.
That's when we started going to counseling. And he told me that if I tried to get divorced from him, that I could leave with the clothes on my back and that he would take the kids and that I would be penniless. And so when I actually asked for a divorce, I thought it best not to be there.
So is it fair to say that this was not a mutual thing between the two of you, that Danny did not want a divorce?
I don't think he wanted to get divorced.
Wendy testified that after the divorce, she started dating a man named Jeffrey LaCasse, but that they broke up just about a week before Dan died. They had a big fight in late June 2014, and she said she didn't want to be with him anymore. She said he accused her of cheating on him. Kawas asked her if there was any way she would have been walking on Trescott Drive, Dan's street, the day before Dan's murder, and Wendy said no. She was asked if detectives ever talked to her brother or parents about the murder, and she said she doesn't think they have.
You are testifying today under a state subpoena, correct?
Correct.
And that state subpoena gives you immunity for your testimony, right?
Yes.
Can you explain to the jury, since you're an attorney, what immunity is?
Immunity is freedom from prosecution.
So that means that anything you say today can't be used against you if the state decides to arrest you later on?
The state isn't going to decide to arrest me.
Do you know if they consider you a suspect?
I don't know.
Wendy testified that 2 years after Dan died, she stopped allowing Dan's parents to see her kids, although she said they've been in discussions the last couple weeks to change that. On redirect, Prosecutor Kappelman asked her more about that.
How many times have Dan's parents been able to see your boys in the last 5 years?
In the last 2 years after they died, they've been able to see them every time they've asked to see them.
Okay, what about the last 3 years?
Since 2016, they have not been permitted to see the boys.
They have not been permitted?
That's right.
By you?
By me, yes.
Right, and that's not through lack of trying on their part?
No, that's because of what they did.
Okay, but they want to see those boys, don't they?
They very much want to see the boys.
All right.
And then one of the jurors asked specifically why the grandparents were not allowed to see the kids.
Well, they were allowed to see the grandchildren for 2 full years, and I used to cook meals for them and arrange play dates. We had sleepovers, and then I found out that that Ruth Markell had reached out to a foster care agency to try to place my children with that agency, and I became very worried that they were trying to take my children away from me, And so after that time, I didn't feel a level of trust that they could spend time with the kids. I was afraid they were trying to take them from me.
Follow-up, Ms. Kaplan.
Your reference to the foster care agency, does that have to do with an email that was sent to me from your mother-in-law?
Yes, it does.
All right, that Dan's mother.
Yes.
And that email was in reference to, in the event that you and your parents were arrested in association with this crime, could I please contact that particular agency to assist with the children in the event they have no guardian temporarily until they could get down here from where they reside in Canada? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so they were not trying to take your children unless there was an event where you were unable to care for them.
But because there's no event in which I would be unable to care for them, that feels like trying to take away my children.
Another question from the jury was what was wrong with the TV that was being repaired on the morning of the murder. Wendy said she thinks that one of her kids threw something at it, and so there was a crack in the screen. Officer Bill Brannon took the stand and testified that he helped put up crime scene tape and maintain a perimeter around Dan's house the morning he was killed. He said right around noon, he noticed a red Odyssey van pull up to the scene. His wife has a similar vehicle, and so it caught his eye right away.
And could you describe how the vehicle, what happened once it pulled up?
Just came up and made a three-point turn and turned around and left the area.
All right. And did it do so? I'm assuming other vehicles probably did the same thing during that time frame you were holding the perimeter, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Because there was no ingress or egress down Trescott past that point, correct?
No.
All right. And the vehicle, did this vehicle turn around in any different fashion from the other ones that you observed turning around?
It seemed to be a little less hesitation compared to other vehicles.
What do you mean by that?
Overruled.
Can you describe what you mean by that?
Average citizens would be pulling up, and there's that kind of pause where I guess they're formulating a new plan, like, oh, I can't go the way I was planning on going. And then, you know, we kind of sit there for a second, and then they'll eventually turn around and go. The way I remember it, this van, I mean, just came right up, made the three-point turn and left. I mean, nothing crazy. It wasn't squealing tires or anything crazy like that, though.
Okay. Would the view that this driver of the van that approached the tape have had, would that driver have had a clear view of Mr. Markell's driveway?
Objection, speculation. Overruled.
You may answer the question.
Should have been.
And would the person driving the van have been able to observe at the time that that person pulled up that there were emergency vehicles present in the driveway of Dan Markell?
It should be evident. There's plenty of emergency response vehicles and stuff on scene. Okay. We're only, like I said, approximately a few houses down.
He made note of the van in his report because he said it matched the description of the vehicle driven by Dan's ex-wife, Wendy. The state then called Wendy's ex-boyfriend, Jeffrey LaCasse, to the stand. Jeffrey testified that he and Wendy started dating in the fall of 2013 and broke up in July 2014, just days before Dan was murdered. He said in March 2014, he, Wendy, Charlie, and Catherine all went out to dinner. He said that Wendy and her family were extremely close. On June 4th, 2014, he testified that Wendy was acting strange.
Yeah, I had met Ms. Adelson at the Red Eye Coffee Shop in Midtown for a coffee about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We were going to talk about our relationship a little bit. And she canceled a trip we had planned to California to visit my parents, which was scheduled for July 11th to 17th.
All right. And was she acting strangely that night?
Yeah, that night she was a nervous wreck to the point, I couldn't put my finger on why at the time, to the point where she lived kind of way up Centerville and there was no convenience stores or anything close. And I actually took about 35 minutes and drove to a convenience store to get her Pepto-Bismol because she was such a nervous wreck and had a real nervous stomach that evening.
Okay. And did she ever tell you what the problem was?
No, she's very nonspecific about it.
He was asked about Wendy's efforts to relocate to South Florida with the children.
Were you in her life when she learned that the court was not going to permit her to take the children?
No, our first date was September 27th, 2013. So that was a topic of conversation on our first couple of dates, but it was in the past when we discussed it.
All right. And was Ms. Adelson happy about the fact that she was not able to relocate?
No, she was quite bitter about it, actually. It was, as I said, a topic that came up. That tone came up on those first two dates.
All right. Did she make any statements to you in reference to her brother considering options to take care of this problem with her not being able to relocate?
Yes, she did.
Sidebar.
Okay.
Catherine's defense team asked for a sidebar before Prosecutor Kappelman's questioning resumed.
All right, Mr. Lacoste, when we broke, we were talking about statements made to you by Wendy Adelson about her brother considering options to take care of her relocation problem. What, if any, statements did she tell you to that effect?
Yes, ma'am. On July 13th, 2014, Wendy and I were speaking, and she asked me if she could share something with me confidentially. I told her, sure. She mentioned, or she said, that Charlie had explored all options to take care of the problem, and that he had looked into having Professor Markell killed. It would cost about $15,000. I later talked to Investigator Isom and said that could have been $50,000. They sound an awful lot alike.
Okay, so you're not sure if she said 15 or 50.
That's right, but I'm confident she made that statement. I just can't remember the exact dollar amount. And she did state that was during the relocation battle the previous summer is when that had taken place.
All right. And the day that she made the statement to you was July 13th of 2014.
Yes, ma'am.
Jeffrey said the next day, July 14th, 2014, Wendy sent him an email that said, "I need a week to think. Please don't contact me." Prosecutor Kappelman asked if Wendy had ever said anything about a celebration dinner after Dan died.
Yes.
Could you tell us about that, please?
Yes. A couple weeks after Professor Markell was murdered, we spoke on the phone, and she had mentioned that her and Charlie had gone to, these are her words, she said, "Charlie and I went to what he described as a celebration dinner."
All right. And that was the dinner where she vomited?
That's right. That's correct.
And are you aware, Mr. Lacoste, that Ms. Adelson suggested you as a possible suspect in this homicide?
Yes, I am.
And where were you when Dan Markell was murdered?
I was on the road to Tennessee. I originally had a trip planned for 11 a.m. on Friday the 18th, and I had, at the last moment, changed my trip to Thursday night. So
you left early?
I left early without telling anyone other than the people at, you know, the destination. Ms. Adelson was the only person I had told in Tallahassee about the time that I was leaving, which was 11 a.m. on the 18th. I had informed her about that in around June 10th.
All right. So originally it was going to be July 18th at 11 a.m. would be your departure?
Yes, ma'am.
And would you be flying or driving?
I was driving.
All right. And it changed to Thursday night, so you left the night before and were in Tennessee at the time of the homicide?
That's correct.
On cross-examination with Sigfredo's attorney, Sam Zanganeh, Jeffrey again said that he told Wendy that he would be traveling out of town on July 18th, 2014, the morning Dan was killed.
So Wendy Adelson knew you were leaving, you told her you were leaving Friday morning.
Friday morning at 11, we had discussed it because we had some plans that got canceled, so we had discussed it in some detail, actually. Yeah.
So your plan was to travel north of Tallahassee to Tennessee, correct?
That's correct.
And you told Wendy that, hey, listen, I'm going on this trip and I'm leaving Friday morning around 11 a.m., correct?
That's correct.
And do you recall what time the actual shooting took place?
I believe it was right around 11 a.m.
The same exact time that you'd be leaving the area, correct?
That's correct.
Zanganeh again pointed out that Wendy had given his name to detectives as a possible suspect in her interview. And that's all for part one of this episode. In part two, we'll hear more trial testimony, including the testimony from Luis Rivera, who not only fingers his best friend Sigfredo Garcia as the shooter, but he also implicates Catherine Magbanua as being the go-between between the Adelson family, who prosecutors say ordered the murder, and Sigfredo. The question is, would his testimony be credible? The prosecution will also present evidence from wiretapped phone calls they listened in on from both Catherine and Charlie's phones. And then later in the trial, we'll hear from Catherine Magbanua herself as she testifies on her own behalf. As always, if you'd like to listen to these episodes ad-free, go to courtjunkie.com/support, and that will link you to my Patreon page where you can donate to this podcast and get some additional perks. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.